Good afternoon, everyone. It's Wednesday, February 26th. This is the APS Portfolio Strategy Call, Bank Perpetual Preferred Issuance and the Transition from LIBOR. I'm Steve Abrahams, Head of Investment Strategy here at Amherst. The market certainly has more than the usual amount of uncertainty these days. If you look at the vol implied by the options market, it's clearly jumped back to the levels that we saw last year around tariffs. And again, this is something that is another global development. In this case, it's the coronavirus. So far, the market has really had to price that risk on a limited base of facts, but I think it's important to point out that we've started to get better information just within the last few days. The World Health Organization reported yesterday that the epidemic in China, at least by its measures, the results of it sending a team to a number of provinces there, has started to abate. And in 14 other countries that WHO is tracking that had reported infections, there have been no new cases in the last week. Also yesterday, the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention weighed in, saying that risk of infection for the general U.S. population is low. That obviously will not be the last word, but it is clearly the best information to date. Whether the market will absorb it and at what pace remains to be seen. With this kind of uncertainty, obviously, it's important to focus on good ideas. It becomes more important than ever. And for this, which is an inaugural call where we're trying to provide some of our ideas to a smaller group, we wanted to turn to Dan Brizzo, who covers IG Financial Credits for us. Dan will make some brief remarks. There's a set of slides up available through the webcast. There's also a way for you to ask questions through the webcast software. You'll notice in the upper right part of your screen, there's a little bubble with a question mark. At any point in the presentation, you can submit a question, and we'll probably get to them at the end of Dan's presentation. In the meantime, Dan, take it away. You have the floor.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Steve. I appreciate it. Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for joining us for today's brief discussion on U.S. bank perpetual preferred issuance. We'll also include, as Steve said, some additional commentary on the transition from LIBOR to SOFR and how that may or may not be impacting valuation in this fixed-to-float structured market. For those of you I haven't had a chance to meet before, my name is Dan Brizzo. I'm one of the senior credit strategists on Amherst's corporate bond trading desk. I joined the firm in early 2019, and I primarily cover the bank and financial sectors, which includes insurance and REITs, and also am responsible for some additional coverage in industrials, which includes transports, air defense, and general manufacturing companies. So as Steve kind of indicated, I recognize the timing of today's call might not seem ideal given the broader market turbulence that and some of the more pressing issues we're seeing related to coronavirus. But as he stated, credit markets this week do seem to be a bit handcuffed. And with the absence of new issue and some of the secondary market trading grinding to a relative halt, with that in mind, it seems like a lot of cash seems to be building up on the sidelines. So I think it doesn't hurt to start to put together a game plan for areas of the market that we might think are worth targeting when investors do re-engage, or at a minimum, the backup and spreads could be providing a window of opportunity in some of the areas that investors might like but have seen as being maybe overbought in the weeks preceding these recent outbreak concerns. The banking sector in particular has been hit pretty hard in the sell-off. Generically speaking, bank spreads are out about, let's call it 12 to 15 basis points wider this week from Friday's close, and that puts us anywhere from 20 to 30, depending on beta, 20 to 30 basis points wider from what we would now call the early February tights. So as most of you who are on the call are probably aware, issuance year to date from the U.S. money center banks has come predominantly in the form of these fixed to float perpetual preferred debt issues. So far, these structures have netted over $9 billion in issuance from the big six alone, with some other deals in the regional space, such as the recent Capital One deal. Now, there are several factors that we think are contributing to this issuance trend. I think the broadest and most obvious is that the market's seemingly endless appetite for yield and therefore willingness to move down into subordinated structures for additional spread is driving the demand function. But there are two other technical factors that are contributing to this trend as well. Number one, the banks have largely filled out their need or their desire to issue regular Tier 2 subordinated debt, and that follows a very heavy issuance period from 2013 to 16, which we see demonstrated in red on the graphic on slide 2. The bulk of those deals issued into the Tier 2 tranche will not be approaching maturity for a couple of years, and therefore we expect issuance for that particular debt structure to remain lean, at least for the foreseeable future. In fact, as we look back, there were no Tier 2 deals, sub-deals, issued out of the big six money center banks in 2019 altogether. So this absence of supply is really creating some pent-up demand in the bank fin space for higher-yielding tranches of debt securities. And number two on the technical front is that if you look again at this graphic on slide two, a large portion of perpetual preferred five-year no-call deals are fast approaching their call dates in 2020 and for the next several years. So you can see that 2013 and 16 through 16 were not only active for the sub-deals, but for preferred issuance as well. So that's shown in purple. And as you can see on the graph, 2015 logged a particularly big year, over $20 billion. So the first of those five no-call deals will begin hitting their respective call dates in the weeks ahead. So it stands to reason that the banks were very quick in January to roll out replacement structures in their first post-earnings debt launches. Given the coupon range of this 2015 vintage, the likelihood of first calls does appear extremely high as these dates begin rolling next month. For the remainder of 2020, we think perpetual preferred issuance will remain active. Already, J.P. Morgan followed up their January preferred launch of $3 billion with an early Feb launch of an additional $1.5 billion, which actually priced at a much lower overall coupon with a significantly lower back end. We think it's reasonable that we might see the Big Six match their 2015 total, which is in excess of $20 billion, for preferred issuance as coupons hit record lows, but also as other forms of TLAC capital, as I mentioned with the sub-2 tranche, remain very robust relative to their regulatory capital needs within their respective cap structures. So now looking at things on an issuer basis on slide 3, overall the banks have a tremendous amount of debt maturing, not just this year, but over the next 3 years. This was a topic we addressed in our 2020 outlook, where we recognized that the gross levels of debt issuance from the big banks would not only remain robust this year, but that investors should also be cognizant of the fact that we may need to see tremendous volume to match the net gains on supply that we saw over the past few years. And we see that right now as being very unlikely, i.e., it's reasonable to say that the bank sector, while seeing a decent amount of gross issuance, could also still see some significant supply pressures, in particular in the second half of this year, as they've been front-loading debt issues over the past several. So as you can see on slide 3, again, taking it down to an issuer basis, Wells Fargo, along with Goldman Sachs and Morgan, appear to be likely to see some of the most supply going forward. While on the other side of the scale, you see Bank of America appears to be under the least pressure to be issuing over the near term, at least just based on what their maturities look like over the next 3 years. This is also true amongst the actual, as I mentioned before, the 2015 five-year no-call preferreds that are hitting their call dates. Bank of America actually has no outstanding issues with 2020 first call dates. So not surprising from their activity so far, J.P. Morgan has the most with $4.5 billion, which they've already roughly matched in the amount that they've issued so far. But I wouldn't exactly say that rules them out for any further activity in this space. Citigroup has $4.25 billion in preferreds hitting their first call dates this year, and that's versus the $1.5 billion they've issued so far. Goldman Sachs has $2 billion and has only brought that small deal, just $350 million, versus the $2 billion that they've got hitting call dates this year. So we could expect more likely from Goldman Sachs. Meanwhile, that leaves Morgan Stanley, which has $1.5 billion hitting first call this year, and they have yet to issue into this preferred tranche. Wells Fargo has just $1 billion reaching their call dates, but they've already issued twice that amount in fixed-rate, five-year, no-call, $25 preferreds. So this demonstrates that we could very well see a lot more on the follow, given the sizable maturity wall for 2020, as well as all the debt that's coming in reaching their first call dates in the current year. Okay, so that moves our discussion into relative value. And in this section, I think we're going to need to take things with a little bit of a grain of salt, just given how fluid valuations have been this week. But generically speaking, we think investors should be positioning aggressively around the January 2020 preferred issues from the Big Six. Even though bonds printed at record low coupons and at record low back-end floating spreads, we think subsequent issuance is going to print even less favorably as the year carries on. And we should benefit from, in any subsequent issuance with lower back-end should benefit the valuation on these first few issues that came through the door. With the market backing up over the past several weeks, the available pickup in these preferred tranches versus bank seniors or senior holdco has migrated more to that 230 to 250 basis point range that was available when they first printed in mid to late January. And that's come back a bit from the lower 200 to 220s range that we started to see in early February when spreads were at their overall tights. So for that 2020 vintage of issuance, that compares with a senior to preferred pick of about 175 to 200 for the 2019 vintage, which obviously has more favorable back-end dynamics and a shorter runway to their calls. In either case, consider that the pick from bank seniors to regular Tier 2 subnotes has remained in a very tight range. And currently, that only accounts for about 15 to 20 basis points to move down in structure from senior holdco to the subordinated Tier 2. Looking at things versus fair value curves, while not, most of this debt issuance in the preferred space is non-index eligible, the size and in some cases the IG ratings puts them into a different category than simply saying it's high yield and non-index eligible. The Citi preferred deal yielding roughly 4.25 would offer roughly a 67 basis point pick to the BB financial curve. The JP Morgan 4.6 perp, the first one, the January issuance, which has mid triple B ratings, would be at a roughly a 4% yield. That would be a 163 pick to low triple B and about a 190 pick to mid triple B. So those are still pretty impressive picks over the fair value curves. Bank of America 430s, which is probably our most favorite pick in this space, they maintain low triple B ratings. Again, their index eligible size. And at a 430 yield, are offering over 193 pick to low triple B financial curve. That's pretty significant, even with notwithstanding some of the tightening we've seen in the bank space over the last couple of months. GS 440 perps at 447 overall yield are about an 86 pick to the double B financial curve, and the JP 4%, the later issue, the February one, offers over 200 basis points pick to the low triple B curve. So while we think the January issues while we like the January issues in general, if we needed to pick on an individual issue basis, again, I'd highlight that lack of anticipated supply in Bank of America, which also boasts IG ratings versus double B at either Citi or Goldman. And we also think the additional preferred supply in JPM is a little bit less likely than some of the other names. And again, this one is also among the IG issues in this space as another reason to favor these two over the issues from peers. Investors obviously remain very cognizant of the back-end floating rate spread when pricing these issues. The JPM January deal is about 30 basis points of yield lower than the February one. For a long period of time, preferred issuance largely adhered to somewhat of an unwritten bogey, I'd say, for back-end in these structures. For a very long period of time, it seemed to be 375 versus 3-month LIBOR was what investors were looking for. But as the appetite for yield has continued to increase and spreads have tightened, that bogey's moved on in through 350 and then into 325. And then obviously where some of these deals are pricing more recently, it's a current level that's well inside of 300. So switching gears a bit, I just want to spend a little bit of time discussing the LIBOR transition and how it may or may not be impacting this market. What seems to be of particular interest in this first batch of 2020 issuance is that it's provided us with securities with a variety of benchmarks as well as different approaches to dividend determination. As you can see here on slide 4, JP and Citi both utilize SOFR rates, while Bank of America kept their float spread in terms of LIBOR, which includes the most recent comprehensive fallback language that has become more common in these floating rate instruments. Meanwhile, Goldman chose to forego either of those two and chose to go against the constant maturity 5-year U.S. Treasury. So far the main takeaway is that the corporate bond market, at least according to the pricing of these new issues, has been fairly confident in modern fallback language. So there's really been no observable price sensitivity to the difference in the use of these benchmarks. Instead, issues appear to be trading at levels that are more indicative of their issuer versus issuer valuation differences that we see in more typical senior and substructures, mostly fixed and fixed with 1-year floating rates that maximize TLAC eligibility. So by that, I mean Goldman is the highest yielding among the 5 recent deals, followed by Bank America, Citi, and then JP, trading with the lowest yield. These deals are priced, it's worth noting, these deals are priced in the secondary market on a dollar basis as well. So in addition to the differences in benchmarks, we also saw some small differences in how and when floating rates are locked in during their float periods. Morgan Stanley and Citi favored a period-end lock, which is to be paid out 2 business days after, versus the Goldman and JP approach, who joined Credit Suisse and a couple of others, who chose to lock 2 or 3 business days, depending on structure, before period-end, and then paying out on the period-end date. So right now, again, as we're seeing with benchmarks, no observable price sensitivity to the differences in these dividend determination approaches. But as is the case with sensitivity to the benchmark, these securities do have a 5-year lock period, 5-year fixed period, which is relatively longer duration than some of the other structures and other sectors. So shorter securities could be demonstrating a little bit more of a different trading pattern. But these remain the most liquid in corporate bank paper and, again, have no observable sensitivity to any of these differences. So one of the things that we think could matter for this issue but hasn't really appeared yet is whether dividend reset aligns with quarter end, because that would make them a little bit more likely to coincide with funding pressures in the broader markets. So, for example, Citi Preferred deal is off by a month. So the quarterly SOFR floating payments would coincide with month-end January, April, July, and then October. Likewise, the Goldman Preferred deal, which is to CMT, remains semi-annual in its floating term, with payments around February 10th and August 10th, so nowhere near an actual quarter-end period when the dividend resets are due. So in instances where securities are structured around actual quarter-end, the issue of whether the lock is 2 days ahead or on the actual quarter-end could actually prove to be more important to investors, given the possible scenario that rates might spike due to perceived funding issues in the final days of the period or quarter. So far, though, it has not been the case in the corporate bond market, and if it does happen, it's likely to have done so by coincidence, given the fact that corporate bond issuers very rarely bring notes that directly coincide with quarter end, as is often the case in the derivatives market. I've spoken with some traders from some of the other sectors to get a feel for whether this issue has been more meaningful elsewhere. In structured products, we've only been involved in a single SOFR-linked note in non-agency RMBS so far. And in that instance, the rate lock was set in the indenture language, was set 2 days ahead of the reset date, which would mean in this extremely limited instance, the The indenture follows the Goldman, Citi, and Credit Suisse approach. And again, from what traders have seen, the detail does not seem to be really influencing the valuation of those securities in any meaningful or observable way. Now, I would caution that this certainly doesn't mean that this is our firm's commitment to any particular approach for future issuance. I think if we start to see patterns or investor concerns emerge, then we will likely reassess each situation on an individual basis, especially for any future issues with payments coinciding with quarter end, when actual funding pressure could be more likely to be raised as a potential cause for concern among investors. But in both cases, the short answer for the corporate bond market so far has been that differences in these dividend reset approaches, or even differences in benchmarks for now, for longer duration resets, do not appear to be influencing valuation, at least not in any way that's readily apparent. The liquid fixed-to-float preferred deals are trading in very similar relationship by issuer as with the fixed senior market, or more common fixed to one-year floating structures that are more common in the big bank space. So that actually takes us to the end of my prepared remarks for now. I'm going to check the queue to see if we've got any questions on the line right now.
Yeah, I just want to remind everybody that on the upper right side of your screen, there's a little bubble with a question mark in it. You can use that to submit a question via chat. If you'd rather submit a question over the phone, you can unmute your line by hitting 4-star, and we'll take your question that way. I guess as we're waiting for people to potentially submit questions, Dan, actually, there's something you mentioned that I wanted to follow up on. I mean, clearly, looking at the way these issues are pricing, as you mentioned, it doesn't seem to be sensitive to the fallback language. Presumably, the market's comfortable with that, and it's mainly pricing based on name. What about the older fallback language that might have been in these deals pre the discussion of transition? Are you seeing any valuation differences from that?
Well, that kind of, it's a good question, Stephen, and it leaves us, because when we look across the vintages of these similar structures, so these are, again, I'm speaking specifically to the big six here. Most of the ones with older fallback language have call dates that are fast approaching and that fall ahead of the deadline. So the quick answer is that it's not influencing because of that fact, and the ones that fall beyond that date mostly have the newer language. So again, back end, the size of the float is having the most influence on valuation, followed secondly by what is going on individual credit basis. So valuation, again, has not really been heavily influenced by those factors in the language.
Okay, thank you. We're getting one question through the chat, and this one really is asking, what are the advantages or disadvantages of choosing the lock date at T-2 instead of locking at the end of the period?
Well, I think it's going to be preference by those that bring the deal. At least that's what we're seeing so far. As I alluded to with regard to period end sensitivity, I think it's going to be outside the scope of the corporate bond market where this is happening. I think by virtue of preference, we're seeing these translate to this market. But where it matters is if it intertwines with period end. If it intertwines with period end, I think locking on period end ensures that you capture any of that volatility that might take place due to funding concerns that might arise at quarter end.
And Dan, you know, I'd actually toss in an observation there, because we've been doing a lot of work on the LIBOR transition across various product categories, and there has been differences, small differences in convention from deal to deal, market to market, although I think it's the case that the Fed, along with ISDA and some of the other members of the ARC committee, are really probably this year especially trying to build in uniformity on some of those details so that everybody kind of moves forward together and you eliminate some of these small frictions. There's another question in the chat. And this one is asking whether, Dan, whether you expect banks to retire existing LIBOR liabilities, or potentially do you think the Fed's going to be pushing banks to do that sort of thing?
Well, I think that's, you know, ultimately that's going to become the million-dollar question, whether the old language is going to be sufficient for the SOFR transfer, or whether we're going to have to have any kind of indenture changes that are initiated, in which case we're going to have large-scale tenders, et cetera, that are done, or consent solicitations rather than tenders, that are done to alter the language in order to make it more ironclad. The short answer, though, for whether or not banks in the near term are going to be redeeming this stuff at first call, just based on the economics of it, I think the answer is very much yes. If you look at where the coupons are, where the back ends are, and where they can capably issue, I think most of these deals that I'm seeing in these aged vintages are very likely to be called at first call.
Okay, so that's interesting. Basically, the market's solving the problem because...
Exactly. The economics are there.
Exactly. The other thing I'm sure that a lot of people on the line realize is that the Fed has very pointedly made it a board-level responsibility at most large banks that they measure their current LIBOR exposure across the balance sheet, both assets and liabilities, and that they have specific people on point to figure out how the bank's going to mitigate that kind of exposure. So, not as a IG specialist, but our perspective from other parts of the firm is that large regulated institutions like banks are clearly feeling the pressure to make sure that they, at the very least, have their LIBOR exposure well explained and, to the extent possible, mitigated.
Absolutely.
So we're getting... We're getting another question, again, back to the lock date. Would you envision standardizing the lock date that the existing contract, or would you need it to be revised or amended?
I think that ultimately investors are going to make that decision for the issuers. I think if they care enough about it, and, again, I think this is going to be much more relevant in derivatives markets where it's built around quarter end, the desire to then lock in those last couple of days, which often prove to be the most volatile from a rate perspective, is much more important in a derivatives market. So, yeah, it's entirely possible that we might just, you know, we have all it's going to take really is one incident. I think where we've got 2 or 3 days of volatility at the end of a quarter, where we're going to choose to standardize it and more likely go with the waiting, you know, with the idea to wait and then pay after the fact, so that you do capture those last 2 days of volatility. But again, because corporates issue when they issue and not necessarily wrapped to any particular period end, it's going to be less of a concern here. And there would be probably, in that regard, less impetus to change the language. And again, unless investors are really clamoring for it.
I'm going to take the prerogative of asking you, I guess, a closing question. I don't see any more in the chat. In your remarks, you were really, you know, addressing the big six, but I think you mentioned at least cap one preferred deal. What are you thinking about the regionals?
Sure. So the cap one is I believe is the only other perpetual preferred that was issued, at least with index eligible size. So they brought $1 billion in January as well, with a 5.55 fixed coupon and a 3-month LIBOR based plus 380 back end for the call period. I think these are very attractively priced. I like the Cap One name overall, and that includes senior fixed securities as well. I know they've gotten a lot tighter in the run up to the end of 2019. But I still think it's a name that has good relative value. I like the operating model. I like the positioning that they have in the consumer space. And right now, with an overall yield to call of 320 on these that actually have one IG rating, I think you've got tremendous pickup versus the overall market. So I do like the Cap One deal. But I would say it's very much a case-by-case basis. I think much of the regional bank space is overbought. It is one of the areas in our outlook coming into 2020 where we said within the context of a market weight overall for banks, We remained very much underweight on regionals given just how tight the sector has gotten.
Okay, fabulous. I'm not seeing more questions coming in via chat, and I've gone dry on my side.
Okay.
But I just want to remind everybody, if you're not aware or not on the distribution, Dan's work, along with Meredith Contente and the rest of the strategy staff, comes out at the very least on a Friday early edition of the APS Portfolio Strategy newsletter, and then again first thing Monday in the regular edition. So if you're not getting that and you want to get access to this work, then please let your sales coverage know. Please also keep an eye on additional emails about more calls that we may be doing on topics as they become relevant in the marketplace. In the meantime, this has been the APS Portfolio Strategy Call, Bank Perpetual Preferred Issuance, and the Transition from LIBOR. Thank you for your time, and thank you for listening this afternoon. That wraps us up.